Hello, and welcome to our program, the National Geographic Society, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Jim Cruz, and for the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the National Geographic magazine and website here on OWL Radio. A few short ones for today. Plant-based meat, making the grade? Nuggets, burgers, bratwurst made of plants. I've tasted them all and become a fan. But there's still that meat mystique. By Mark Wilson. The portobellos strike my croissant pan with a sizzle. Leeks, onions, carrots go in next, along with a full bottle of California Cabernet. After hours of braising, I reduce the burgundy slurry to syrup, which I spoon over the mushrooms again and again until they're glazed like an ube donut. Because Chef Thomas Keller's braised short ribs was my favorite meat dish, I felt confident adapting the recipe with portobellos for my first vegan Thanksgiving. But as I place the mushrooms onto the plates of my guests, some of my closest relatives already sensed that I'd made a mistake. The portobellos that had turned the unappealing color of organ meat. As I sliced in, they didn't taste bad. They simply tasted like portobellos. Every single portobello I've ever eaten, off every single vegetarian menu anywhere. To this day, I remember it as the Thanksgiving when no one talked. It was never my mission to exalt vegetables. I was a nose-to-tail carnivore until a high cholesterol diagnosis led me to embrace a plant-dominant diet. And I certainly couldn't have imagined at that Thanksgiving that a decade later, I'd be one of the nation's principal journalists covering the new wave of plant-based proteins. Impossible, incredible, awesome, sensational, beyond. Meat alternatives branded with these and other superlatives now constitute a multi-billion dollar market that could be nearly 20 times larger by 2030. And yet, my singular question about each new product is always the same. Well, what does that taste like? Does it taste like meat? Quite often it does. These new foods are engineered to mimic meat, designed to match its distinct chewiness, bloodiness, and umami flavor. Nowhere is this achievement clearer than at Beyond Meat's laboratory in Los Angeles. There, the company puts beef and chicken samples under a microscope to understand how their proteins and fats are woven together. Then it uses all the modern marvels of industrial production. Heating, cooling, same extrusion process used to make Cheetos, to alchemize animal doppelgangers out of pea protein, coconut oil, and other non-meat ingredients. Meat is something special to Americans in that it's absolutely mundane. We in the United States eat more meat than ever before, a total of 264 pounds of beef, veal, pork, chicken per person per year. And though we've curbed our love for beef over the past 40 years, we're more than made up those pounds in chicken. 8 years ago, to avoid going on medication to correct my high cholesterol, I switched to a diet that's 85% plants and plant-based foods. So far, it's working. Only as I consumed less meat did I begin to see the meat all around me driving this market by char-grilling its way across every avenue of advertising into my consciousness. A single hamburger is, by all measures, an unsustainable product, requiring 660 gallons of water to produce, including lettuce, tomato, and a bun. And yet, we've come to expect this subsidized luxury, the result of tens of billions of dollars in annual U.S. reimbursements to the meat and dairy industries over the past decade, versus a fraction of that subsidizing fruits and veggies. None of the meat's true cost, ethical, environmental, and nutritional, really matters to most people. An Arby's restaurant executive told me in 2019, He also vowed that his company would never sell plant meat because, as he declared, people are not going to pay more for something that tastes worse. Years before that conversation, when I first adopted what I call my mostly vegan diet, I hunted down the first, finest plant-based meats that America's chefs had to offer. I sampled jackfruit, carnitas, on home-pressed masa tortillas at Gracias Madre in San Francisco, a beet-dyed seitan Reuben at the Chicago Diner, and the namesake sandwich at Superiority Burger, a mixture of quinoa, chickpeas, walnuts, and veggies in New York City. All were just as delicious and functionally not replicable in my daily life as Thomas Keller's short ribs. But still, they weren't quite meat. So I turned to the machines of industrialization, which over the past decade have been churning out a Cambrian explosion of plant-based alternatives made for meat-loving Americans. When companies have new products they want me to try, they overnight them to me with dry ice. The resulting skyscraper of plastic foam coolers in my garage is the worst skeleton in my closet. I've tasted dozens of plant meat items, burgers, bratwursts, bacon, churros, taco meat, Italian sausages, breakfast sausages, meatballs, chicken fingers, chicken nuggets, beef jerky. Now that I've eaten just about every major product on the market, I appreciate each of its distinctive sensations. I find myself wishing I could mix and match their traits to create a super meat of sorts. One plant meat to rule them all. I'm fascinated by the way that daring chicken chunks char up in a pan, just like a leg of chicken on the grill, and the way an impossible burger bleeds heme, a meaty-tasting form of iron that's produced here with soy protein instead of animal protein. I find it remarkable how Kentucky Fried Chicken's Beyond Fried Chicken chunks shred with the same stringiness as ever-so-overlooked white meat, which is imperfect at recreating the sensation of KFC's. My biggest shock recently was a chicken breast made with mycelium, the subterranean heart of a mushroom. It looked like a giant breaded guitar pick, but flavor-wise was so indistinguishable from breaded baked chicken that I wondered, from a practical standpoint, why we still bother raising chickens, or portobellos for that matter. Yeah, no company is good at making everything. When I tried the same vendor's steak made with the same mycelium, it had the texture of an aged filet, but the odor of a Subway pole. I watch the plant-based meat industry like I watch the Chicago Bears, with marvel, skepticism, frequent disappointment. But truth be told, much of the world solved its meat addiction millennia ago. Examine cuisines across the world, and you'll see that cultures have evolved to harvest protein without meat. I'm not simply referring to the original plant meats. Tofu, commonly thought to have been invented during the Han Dynasty, circa 150 BC, or seitan, thought to have been developed in the area even earlier. In Mexico, corn tortillas and beans marry the essential amino acids to create a complete protein. Across South America, it's beans and rice. In Ethiopia, it's lentils and the ancient grain teff. And in India, ground rice and black gram, a relative of the mung bean, ferment together into a batter used to make steamed idli cakes and crisp dosas. It's difficult to imagine the human sacrifices that brought our culture this incredible knowledge. How many poisonous things did we eat before we learned that rice was worth cultivating? How many generations were malnourished until a tribe realized that one family, stronger and healthier than the rest, ate certain plants in combination? The first amino acid wasn't discovered until 1806, from asparagus, by the way. The last wasn't discovered for another 100 to 130 years. By the time scientists found the 20 amino acids inside a complete protein, cultures had been reverse engineering them into their diets for thousands of years. Through this historical lens, I will admit that I begin to see plant meat differently and for what it really is. Consider that when we talk of the pea protein inside any popular plant burger, it's not made from garden-fresh green peas, but from an ingredient many Americans ignore in the grocery's ethnic food aisles, the split yellow peas cooked into popular Indian dals. Here, the cutting-edge combination of pea protein and rice in a plant-based burger is not particularly novel or unique. Rather, it is what the West does best. We reconstituted tradition into a logo. Repackaging these staple proteins as meat is more than a hot business trend. It's the colonization of global diet. We're Americanizing and corporatizing the very components behind historical meatless world cuisines that have successfully and satisfyingly fed countless generations. And yet, standing in my backyard with a bottle of light beer in my hand and an impossible burger on the grill, I feel a certain satisfaction. I'm reaching my own manifest destiny as a suburban American man, all while dodging the guilt of greenhouse gases, animal cruelty, and the damage I'm doing to my own heart. This bleeding patty is desire. This bleeding patty is patriotism. This bleeding patty is brand. Is meat. Mark Wilson, global design editor of Fast Company, has been writing about design, food, technology, and culture for nearly two decades, and he still loves a meatball sub. Okay, short one, the meat of the matter. The United States leads the world in meat consumption per capita, with an intake three times as high as the world average. But in the U.S. and other high-income nations, demand is expected to level off as populations age and add more diverse protein sources to their diets. The shift to poultry over the past three decades has been driven by the perception that while meat is a better food choice and more convenient to prepare. Dispatches from the front lines of science and innovation. Warmer alpine greening. Satellite images of the Alps show that the amount of vegetation above the tree line has increased by nearly 80% in less than 40 years. As climate change warms the region, new species may outcompete those used to harsher conditions, such as the Edelweiss. Speaking eye to eye, muscles make faces more expressive in dogs and humans than in wolves. Saying no when Fido gives you his best puppy dog eyes can be extremely difficult. For thousands of years, dogs have been cajoling people by making this pitiful, adorable expression, an ability that may be the result of selective breeding, a new study says. Tiny muscles around the eyes and mouth enable terrestrial mammals to form myriad facial expressions. These muscles are more similar in dogs and humans than in dogs and wolves, says the study by researchers from Pittsburgh's Duquesne University. In wolves, most of the facial muscles are slow twitch fibers, which adjust less rapidly, while in humans and domesticated dogs, most of the muscles are fast twitch fibers, which react quickly. It's this musculature difference that allows dogs to make puppy dog eyes and other animated human-like expressions that wolves can't. Communicating with facial cues is fundamental to all humans, says lead study author Ann Burroughs. So it seems reasonable that we would have selected dogs during selective breeding that would gaze into our eyes. Burroughs and colleagues are now investigating whether the evolution of fast-twitching muscles around dogs' mouths played a role in the barks they developed to communicate. The butterfly effect via 3D printing. Light interacting with microscopic ridges on the wing surfaces of the African Sinandra opus, a butterfly, gives rise to iridescence. These structural colors can appear in a wide spectrum of visible hues, including some not in the butterfly's pigmentation. Now, researchers in Switzerland have replicated the wing's nanostructure with 3D printing on translucent plastic. The innovation could be used for banknotes, inks, and display screens. Innovator Keolu Fox. He analyzes DNA to empower indigenous populations. When a graduate school professor told Native Hawaiian Keolu Fox that studying the genetics and genomics of indigenous people was career suicide, Fox found that all his projects would prioritize the health of minorities. Fox followed through on that commitment after learning that most genetic studies and clinical trials are based on people of European ancestry, a bias that could result in unsafe or useless treatments for people of other backgrounds, as well as policies that compound health inequities. An assistant professor at the University of California, San Diego, and a National Geographic explorer, Fox says it's critical for historically vulnerable communities to be in control of their information. So, he co-founded the school's Indigenous Futures Institute and the Native Biodata Consortium, which he calls the Motown Records of Genomics. Fox believes that identifying genetic signatures that predispose indigenous peoples to disease and others that confer adaptations to their native lands could lead to better medicines and health care. To ensure that indigenous peoples benefit from drugs developed from their genes, he wants them to receive at least 4% of the revenue, money he hopes they'll use to take back ancestral grounds that shaped their genomes. Octomothers. After mating, female octopuses care for their eggs, sometimes tens of thousands of them, an elaborate ritual that's their final act. Octopuses fascinate us with their dexterity and keen intelligence, their capacity for problem solving and play. Most coastal octopus species live for about a year. The largest and longest lived, the giant Pacific octopus, may live up to 5. Most octopuses reproduce just once, late in life. And at this time, they enter senescence, a months-long period of decline marked by diminished feeding and coordination, tissue breakdown, and even self-cannibalization. What explains these phenomena? Scientists suggest that this fast-growing competitive species evolved an internal self-destruct system that triggers mature animals' death after reproduction to make way for a new generation. Number 1. Cephalopod sex. A male extends a specialized arm into the female's mantle to pass a sperm packet, a spermatophore, which she stores until egg laying. Number 2. Stringing the pearls. The female fertilizes her eggs from saved sperm, strings them together, and attaches them to the den wall. A giant Pacific brood averages about 100,000 eggs. Number 3. Beginning of the end. Hormones released from the optic gland boost maternal behaviors and discourage foraging and eating. An octopus in senescence stays in her den, guarding her eggs, and may lose more than half her body weight. And finally, number 4, living on. As her life is ending, the mother may help her babies emerge from the den and disperse to open water. Only a small fraction of hatchlings will reach adulthood. Planet Possible. Throughout the holiday that will close out 2022, may we all find ways to celebrate sustainability. Green, the greenery. Each Christmas, revelers glorify live trees. But later, millions of firs, pines, and spruces end up decomposing in dumps, releasing methane into the environment. Now, some green-thumbed companies are renting out trees, which they tend the rest of the year. If you prefer to buy, look for local growers with advice on where to recycle. To complete the natural look, make ornaments from collected and dried foliage. Go for a healthy glow, whether illuminating the menorah during Hanukkah, the Kanara during Kwanzaa, or tea lights during Diwali. Consider how the candles are created. They are often manufactured paraffin wax, a petroleum-based fossil fuel. Affordable and cleaner alternatives include those made with soy, ethical beeswax, and coconut wax. Using artificial lights, LEDs are eco-friendly. Save on gift wrap. Some 2.3 million pounds of wrapping paper go to landfills every year, according to Recycling Database. The Japanese tradition of furoshiki, swaddling gifts in reusable squares of cloth, is a festive form of packaging that doesn't compromise forests. Simpler still, wrap with brown paper grocery bags. Watch the waste. Holiday traditions often include tables laden with tasty fare. But a third of the food produced for human consumption each year goes to waste, the UN World Food Program reports. Instead of throwing away the excess, find groups that redistribute it at epa.gov by searching for Reduce Wasted Food. What's no longer edible might be compostable. Okay, these birds stage rowdy love-ins on rocky coasts. For 36 years, biologist Ian Jones has been studying the crested auklet. The small seabirds flock in ocean waters between Siberia and Alaska. They nest in colonies on rocky coasts of remote islands. And each spring, they hold courtship displays that resemble rowdy carnal swim parties. Jones, a professor at Memorial University in Newfoundland, has observed the birds' 8-week breeding season. Sights, sounds, smells, and moves. And some, he says, it looks like some sort of 1960s-style lovin'. When the snowmelt signals spring, crested auklet males of breeding age choose a courtship staging spot, and the flaunting begins. The males puff up their feathers, strut around, and flash their forward curving crest. The size does matter to females, researchers have shown. They also make trumpeting, hooting, yapping sounds, like the barking of small dogs, Jones says. If a female likes a male's show, she approaches him. If there's mutual interest, both birds pose, vocalize, and stroke each other with their bills. That distributes a tangerine-scented substance released from a gland beneath their nape feathers. The smell may be an auklet turn-on, and the bird is already extremely gregarious, Jones says. You have a 1 meter square flat rock with hundreds of birds on it, jostling, crowding, and doing all sorts of weird things. A couple's wooing usually leads to intertwining of necks, then mating, but never on dry land, Jones says. They do it frequently, several times in an hour, and always at sea. Not always alone, however, sometimes a scrum of other auklets tries to thwart or cut in on the sex until the male backs them off with jabs of his bill. In a single season, the mates produce one egg, co-parent during the chick's early months, and often remain a pair. The next year, the same birds may find each other and do it all again. The crested auklet, native to the northern Pacific Ocean, is the seabird flocks in ice-free waters and nests in colonies on coastlines and cliffs. Although the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species assesses it as a least concern now, the population is affected by invasive predators and climate change. Threads of Memory, The Art of Felting Carpets. For warming stone homes for decoration and cultural expression has long been a pursuit of women and girls in Ingushetia, one of Russia's southernmost republics. Folk music has immortalized the wisdom woven into these rugs called istings in English, which are traditional throughout South Central Asia and the Caucasus. But the labor-intensive craft, foundered in Ingushetia after Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin ordered the deportation of nearly the entire predominantly Muslim populace during World War II. "We had to hurry," says Ingush ethnographer Tanzil Zurabba. 10 years ago, she and a small group of young enthusiasts scoured their mountainous homeland for carpet fragments, memories, guidance. The investigation led to a new workshop in the capital, Magas, as well as classes in schools, competitions, and a book that includes hundreds of historical ornaments, designs. From fertility symbols for newlyweds to labyrinths intended to confuse evil spirits. In this photo, taken in the village of Kiraka, Kaba Kodizeva displays an isting by Zelina Kamakova, both of whom learned felting at the Maga's workshop. Today, the wool craft is a thread connecting them to generations of women before, says Dalrazova. It is as if there's a genetic memory in the hands. The picture is of a young woman clad in a red velvet felt that flows around her. Behind her is open prairie, and then behind that, huge mountain tops. Well, you've been listening to the National Geographic Society here on OWL Radio. Now, you can listen to OWL Radio on our specially tuned radio. You can also listen by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Well, thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. Until next time, this is Jim Cruz saying goodbye from OWL Radio.